Welcome back, Hemming Brainiacs, to the Hemming Brainiac List, the podcast of excellence. We're talking about Book 2, Chapter 16. I suppose you'd call that an anti-climax, if you know what I mean. Sounds like they had some awkward sex. I am cooking at the moment, so I am going to have to step away from the microphone in about, 2 minutes to turn my stove off. I impulse bought some croissants on the way out of Aldi because I'm just a sucker for a croissant, you know. And I thought, I'm pretty sure I've got some kind of a jam at home, a jelly, if you're an American. Bit of croissant with a blueberry jam or something like that. Turns out I didn't have anything like that tucked away in the back of the fridge. So I found some frozen blueberries in the freezer and some sugar, and I'm making a blueberry syrup. It's sizzling in a pot right now, and I'm going to have that on my croissants. I'll go and check on that in a second. I'll just read the comments first because there's only two. Swim said the Mum of Fishy says, I enjoyed this chapter a lot. So comedic, yet so poignant. I thought it was quite funny as well. I don't know, Andrew, I think you made a pun. I did make a pun, the anti-climax pun. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Laura Weistich says, I enjoyed it too, but it was sad at the end, especially for Matilda. Yeah, it was a bit, sad, anticlimactic, like they built it up so much, but I don't think it's beyond recovery, you know? Sometimes your first kind of like encounter, romantic encounter with someone can just be a little bit sort of like weird. And often when you have built it up so much, so I don't know, maybe it won't be such a problem for him. Maybe it will, who knows? Okay, I need to go and turn my stove off. You just have a moment to yourself. I mean, sugar and berries, and then you just kind of like cook them. How can you go wrong with that? All right, that's the conversation for this chapter done. Short and sweet, hey? And also, that's my after-dinner snack complete. Now we're going to continue on and read chapter 17, which is called An Old Sword. I now mean to be serious. It is time. Since laughter nowadays is deemed too serious, a jest advised by virtue is called a crime. Donjon, Canto 13. She did not appear at dinner. In the evening she came into the salon for a moment, but did not look at Julian. Such behaviour seemed strange to him, but I don't know their ways, thought he. She will be able to provide me with good reason for all this. Nevertheless, driven on by extreme curiosity, he studied the expression on Matilda's face. He could not conceal from himself that she wore a contained and hostile look. Surely this wasn't the same woman who last night felt, or pretended to feel, transports of happiness too excessive to be real. The next day, the day after that, the same coldness on her part. She did not look at him, she did not notice his existence. Devoured by a most lively anxiety, Julian was now 1,000 miles away from the feelings of pure triumph that had rushed through him on the first day. Could it, by any chance, he asked himself, be a return to virtue? But the word was rather too bourgeois for the haughty Matilda. In the everyday situations in life, she does not believe in religion at all, he thought. She values it as being extremely useful to the interests of her class, but Might not it be simple feelings of delicacy that reproach her so vividly for her lapse? Julian was sure that he had been her first lover. But, he said to himself, at other moments, one has to admit that there is nothing naive or simple or tender in her whole mode of life. I have never seen her haughtier than just now. Does she despise me? It would be just like her to reproach herself with that she has done for me solely on account of the lowness of my birth. While Julian, filled with assumptions gleaned from books and from his memories of Verrieres, was going on the illusory ideal of a tender mistress who ceases to think of her own existence the moment she makes her lover happy, Matilda's vanity was enraged at him. Since she had not been bored for 2 months, she no longer dreaded boredom, so without in the least suspecting it, Julian had lost his great advantage. I have provided myself with a master, said Mademoiselle de la Mole to herself, victim to the blackest remorse. He is full of honourable sentiments, very well then, but if I push his vanity to its end, he will avenge himself by making the nature of our relations known. Matilda had never had a lover before, and in this, the time of life that provides some tender illusions for even the driest of souls, she was prey to the most bitter reflections. He wields immense power over me since he rules by terror and can punish me atrociously if I provoke him. This idea alone was enough to drive Mademoiselle de la Mole to insult him. Daring was the prime quality of her character. Nothing could so well furnish her with some agitation and offer a relief to her endlessly renewed stock of boredom. As the sensation that she was setting her whole existence upon the toss of a coin. On the third day after dinner, and since Mademoiselle de la Mole persisted in avoiding his glance, Julian followed her, in spite of herself, into the billiard room. Ah, so, monsieur, you think you have acquired some rather powerful rights over me, she said with barely contained anger. Since, quite against my most clearly indicated wishes, you insist on talking to me. Do you realize that no one in the whole world has ever dared as much? Nothing could be more amusing than the conversation between these two lovers who, without suspecting it, were fired by the most vivid feelings of mutual hatred. As neither of them had a long-suffering nature, and in any case both were used to the customs of polite society, they soon came to the point of declaring openly that they had quarrelled for ever. "I swear eternal secrecy to you," said Julian, "and I will even add that I would never address another word to you if it weren't that your reputation would suffer from too marked a change." He bowed respectfully and departed. He managed to carry out what he thought was his duty quite painlessly. He was certainly far from believing himself much in love with Mademoiselle de la Mole. Assuredly, he had not loved her 3 days previously, when he had stood hidden in the great mahogany wardrobe. But from the moment he saw himself as having quarrelled with her for ever, all was rapidly transformed within him. His pitiless memory began to go back again over the slightest details of that night, which, in reality, had left him so cold. In the very night following the declaration of eternal separation, Julian almost went mad on finding himself forced to admit that he adored Mademoiselle de la Mole. Terrible struggles followed on this discovery. All his feelings were thrown into total confusion. 2 days later, in place of behaving proudly to Monsieur de Croisenois, he could almost have embraced him, melting with tears. The experience of a continuing unhappiness provided him with a glimmer of common sense. He decided to leave for the Languedoc, packed his trunk, and went to the postal depot. He felt himself near to swooning when, on arriving at the coach office, he was told that by an odd chance there was a place on the Toulouse mail the following day. He reserved it and returned to the Hotel de la Mole to announce his departure to the Marquise. Monsieur de la Mole was out, more dead than alive. Julian went to wait for him in the library. Imagine his feelings on finding Mademoiselle de la Mole already there. Seeing him come in, she assumed an air of hostility that he could not possibly misinterpret. Transported by misery, dazed by surprise, Julian had the weakness to bring out in the tenderest and most heartfelt manner, "Then you don't love me any more." "I'm horrified at having given myself to the first comer," answered Matilda, weeping tears of rage against herself. "To the first comer," exclaimed Julian. and he sprung to an antique medieval sword which was kept in the library as a curiosity. His pain, which he had thought extreme when he spoke to Mademoiselle de la Mole, had now been increased 100-fold by the tears of shame he saw her shed. He would have been most happy to have had the power to kill her. Just as he succeeded with some difficulty in drawing the sword from its ancient scabbard, Matilda, delighted at so novel a sensation, advanced proudly towards him. Her tears had dried up. The image of the Marquise de la Mole, his benefactor, came vividly to Julian's mind. "And I'm about to kill his daughter," he cried to himself. "How appalling!" He made as if to throw the sword from him. Certainly, he thought, she is going to burst out laughing at the sight of this melodramatic gesture, and the thought helped him regain complete possession of himself. He examined the ancient blade attentively, as though looking for a speck of rust. Then he put it back in its scabbard, and, with the greatest of calmness, hung it up again on the gilded brass nail. The whole of this episode, much drawn out towards the end, had lasted a good minute. Mademoiselle de la Mole stared at him in astonishment. "I've just been on the point of being slain by my lover," she said to herself. The idea carried her off to the finest days of the age of Charles IX and Henry III. She stood stock still in front of Julian, who had just replaced the sword. She gazed at him with eyes no longer full of hatred. It must be admitted that she was wonderfully appealing at that moment, and certainly no woman ever less resembled a Parisian doll, Julian's favourite word of criticism of woman thereabout. "I'm going to fall back into some weakness for him," thought Matilda. "Then immediately he will think himself my lord and master, after a relapse, and at the precise moment I have just taken a firm line with him." She fled. "My God, how beautiful she is," said Julian, watching her run out. "There goes the creature who threw herself into my arms with so much fervour less than a week ago, and those moments will never return, and it's my fault, and while so extraordinary a thing was happening to me, one of such vital concern, I did not even feel it at all vividly. I have to acknowledge that I was born with a very dull, a most wretched temperament." The Marquise appeared. Julian hastened to announce his departure. "Wherefore?" asked Monsieur de la Mole. "For the Languedoc." "Oh no, I beg your pardon, you are reserved for higher things, and if you leave, it will be for the north. I, to use a military term, I will even confine you to the hotel. You will oblige me by never being more than 2 or 3 hours away. I may need you from one moment to the next." Julian bowed, and amazing, the Marquise went out without saying a word. He was incapable of speech and shut himself up in his room. There he was free to exaggerate all the terrible cruelty of his fate. "So," thought he, "I can't even get away. Heaven knows how many days the Marquise will keep me in Paris. Great God, what will become of me? And not a single friend whose advice I can ask. A Pirard wouldn't let me finish my sentence. Comte Altamira would suggest I join in some conspiracy. And yet I'm going mad. I feel it. I'm going mad. Who can guide me? What will become of me?" And that's another chapter. Chaptered. Have your say at the Hemingway List subreddit. Contribute, if you would like to, at patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. Much appreciated, all the donations there. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.